Thursday Night Tailgate, where the spotlight is always on the positive. Tune in Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time to hear your favorite NFL legends, players, and coaches sharing their stories. Now back to Chris and Bob.
I wouldn't joke about anything else that happened to you tonight.
And now back with us here on Thursday Night Tailgate is former Atlanta Falcons and Los Angeles Rams Pro Bowl quarterback Steve Barkowski. Let me remind you about Steve's background. He's from Des Moines, Iowa. He attended the University of California at Berkeley, where he played both football and baseball and was an All-American in both. His senior season, he led the nation in passing, and he helped the Bears to a 7-3-1 record. He was a first-round draft pick, the number one overall selection in 1975 by the Atlanta Falcons. Played in the league from 75 to 86, and all but the last season was here in Atlanta. Like I mentioned, his final season was with the Rams. He was named Rookie of the Year in 1975. He helped the Falcons to their first ever playoff berth in 1978 and their first division title in 1980. He led the league that year with 31 touchdown passes. He was the league leader in passer rating in 1983 and completion percentage in 84. He was named to the Pro Bowl in 1980 and 81. 2004, he was a part of the Falcons' inaugural Ring of Honor honorees. 2007, Steve was elected to the Georgia Sports Hall of Fame, and we are honored he is back with us again tonight here on Thursday Night Tailgate. Hey, Steve, Chris, and Bob, thanks for coming back
on the
show.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Bob. Good to be with you.
Steve, I want to start off by thanking you again, first of all, for the time I got to spend with you last week at the Legends event and for a few minutes at Lee Steinberg's party. It was great getting to spend that time with you, and I'm sure the demands on your time last week coming back to Atlanta had to be outstanding, had to be exhausted by the end of it.
I was glad to see it kind of come and go for sure, Chris. But I enjoyed my time with you, and the few minutes I got in at the Steinberg event, I was disappointed to miss the presentation, but I told Lee that I had a previous commitment to the fly fishing show that was in Atlanta, promoting my son and my fly fishing lodge up here in Southwest Montana. And, told him I couldn't make it till 2 o'clock. I pulled in about 2:03 and heard the news that he'd already given the humanitarian award out. So disappointed about that. But, it was a pretty hectic week for sure.
And staying on that point about your fly fishing lodge, as I was doing the research and spending time with you and looking at it, it's an outstanding looking place online from the website, Ruby Drake Lodge up in Montana. Talk about what you and your son have going on up there.
Well, it's really, really a cool place. It's a little hard to describe, Chris. It's a bit like trying to describe a sunset to a blind man. You don't have the words for it. We're set in a river valley, and maybe the prettiest valley in the lower 48 called the Ruby Valley. The lodge is right on the Ruby River. And we're at about 4,300 feet, and we have five different mountain ranges that surround us on the west, the south, and the east sides, and they all have 10,000-foot peaks. So it's a pretty spectacular scenery to wake up to every morning. And the lodge is something that sort of been a lifelong ambition of mine, trying to figure out how to make a living doing something I love. And, my son, Pete, he got the opportunity to move into the lead guide outfitter role. And, he jumped on that and he needed some help at the lodge, and I went to work for him. So that's kind of what you have there. But so we're having a blast. We're embarking on our third season now. It's just starting to book up, and the bookings are going well, and, the fishing is great. We've got five spectacular rivers that we fish, the Ruby, Madison, the Jefferson, and the Big Hole, and the Beaverhead. And they're all wild trout water, some of the best scenic and most incredible rivers that you could ever put a fly line on. So anyway, that's what I've been doing, and I've been doing it now for, 3 years, and we're having a blast doing it.
It looks spectacular online, so kudos to your son and you, and we'll talk a little bit more about it.
Thank you.
Before we let you go. But Steve, I got to get your thoughts on the Super Bowl. I know you were real busy doing the Expo, but did you get an opportunity to check out the game? And what are your thoughts from what you saw?
Yeah, I did. I got unfortunately, I had a ticket to the game. It was one of the dullest football games I think I've ever seen. Really surprised at how poorly the offenses on both sides played. I really anticipated them being able to make some critical changes at halftime. They had a 35-minute halftime, so As the Patriots did when they played the Falcons, they just got destroyed by the Falcons in the first half. You know, and Lady Gaga got up there and spent 30-some-odd minutes. I think Belichick put in a brand-new offense, you know, and attacked what Atlanta was doing and doing well on defense. I expected the same thing, and I didn't see it. I didn't see a whole lot of changes in either offensive scheme, and therefore I think it was a pretty dull game, to be honest. I can understand why the viewership was down because I would have left at halftime. I was wondering if maybe we could get Maroon 5 back for the fourth quarter, you know, instead of letting the guys play football.
Were you surprised at all by the lack of touches that Todd Gurley got, you know, in the postseason? 16 carries for 115 against the Cowboys, but then only 4 carries for 10 yards against the Saints and only 10 carries for 35 yards in the Super Bowl against the Patriots. Did that surprise you that they only utilized him that much?
Yeah, you know, there's something up with that. I don't know what it is. I don't think he was the same football player at the end of the season that he was at the beginning. And that generally, to me, that denotes, you know, some sort of a lower body injury, leg, ankle, something. I don't know if it's showing up on the injury report, but he just didn't look like the same football player. You know, it's incredible, but, you know, the Patriots seem to go about taking away what you do best, and they did a really good job, I thought, of getting pressure on Jared Goff. You know, I mean, poor guy, I mean, he didn't have time to set his feet on so many throws, and every time he got rid of one, he was getting in the face. So, you know, they just outplayed him. I mean, plain and simple, they outplayed, you know, maybe the best defense on the other side of the ball. I thought the Rams defense would be, you know, more than an overmatch for the Patriot offense, and that didn't turn out to be so true. It looked like the Rams played a really solid defensive game, but they weren't dominant like they were against a lot of teams.
Bob, questions for Steve?
It's always great to have you on the show, Steve, and I wanted to ask you about your recruitment to Cal Berkeley back in the day, and we knew you had a successful high school career, Steve, and being out in California, you were close, but as far as other schools that had interest, Steve, and did the Cal Berkeley academic reputation have something to do with it also?
Well, Bob, honestly, I knew I was going to stay close to home. I had over 100 scholarship offers. I only took a few trips. I was interested in Notre Dame. I was interested in UCLA. Unfortunately, the style of offense UCLA was playing didn't suit my skill set. They were running the wishbone with Pepper Rogers down there. So I knew it was going to be between Stanford and Cal. And honestly, Stanford was 15 minutes from where I grew up in Santa Clara, and that's really where I wanted to go. But there was something about the mystique of Jim Plunkett that I just didn't want to follow or try to follow in his footsteps. And Jim has become one of my best friends, or really good friends. And, you know, I just have so much respect for him and the career that he had at Stanford that I thought for sure that the next, you know, several years they were going to be looking for the next Jim Plunkett. And as it turned out, they were. So, you know, I chose to go to Cal just simply because it was the next best opportunity for me to stay close enough to home so my dad could stay involved in my athletic life. He was an important part, especially of my baseball upbringing. Still the best coach I ever played for in the hardball game. So, you know, it was a pretty simple decision. I had to let go of you know, where my heart was kind of telling me you belong at Stanford, and my head was telling me that no, let's go and see if we can turn the program around up at Cal. So that's what I opted for.
And Steve, I want to fast forward to your rookie year in Atlanta, and I was looking over that roster, and it all came back to me that Pat Sullivan was on that team. And Pat Sullivan was one of these guys. Oh, you know, I was a very young guy watching this guy in college, obviously a Heisman Trophy winner. And you just kind of forgot about him. He only played 4 years in Atlanta, he was out of football in his mid-20s. And I know you coming up had something to do with him not playing in Atlanta. But tell us more about him, Steve. Why you think he never had really success at the pro level? Just one of these Heisman guys that just never could translate to the NFL.
Yeah, it's sort of baffling because you watch him throw 7-on-7. He was incredible. He had a great arm. He had a very kind of a low, slung a little bit like a Phillip Rivers delivery. And at 6 foot or maybe a little under 6 foot, you know, that just didn't play well in that game during that era. You know, they were looking for guys with, you know, 6'4" frames and, you know, overhand deliveries. You know, the game's changed so much. I mean, that's why I think you're seeing some of these guys like Baker Mayfield and some of these guys like Russell Wilson having the kind of success they have, it because, you know, they move the pocket around and these guys are play extenders. You know, they're guys that can make something out of nothing with their feet and move around to buy some more time to get some guys open. I think Patty, if he would have played in this era, he would have had more of a chance than what he did back in the mid 70s. He just never really got a chance. And it's not fair. I think he went on to be a terrific coach and, you know, he had a great career because he had a lot of football knowledge and he's a guy that I learned a lot from my rookie years.
Steve, from listening to stories that you and Lynn Cain were telling, when we were together last week, that 1980 Falcons team is likely the best team maybe the Falcons ever had. You had guys like William Andrews and Wallace Francis, Alfred Jenkins, Alfred Jackson, Junior Miller at tight end, plus a great offensive line. Talk about what it was like playing with all those guys.
Yeah, Chris, that was our opportunity. That was, the best team that I'd ever played on at the pro level. Just loaded offensively, could do pretty much anything we wanted to do. We could throw it, we could run it. We were really good at game management, and it was our chance. I mean, that was our chance. The roster was stacked, a really solid offensive line, a couple guys that ought to be in the Hall of Fame, Mike Cannon, Jeff Eno. It baffles me how these guys sort of get blackballed or pushed to the side because they didn't play, you know, for the Dallas Cowboys or you know, one of these other, you know, feature franchises. And it's really unfair, and something that, sort of grates on me because I know how great Mike Ken was, and I know how great, you know, Jeff Van Oat was, and, you know, I mean, they were a big part of our success, you know, their veteran leadership, and we got in the playoffs, and Dallas got sort of bushwhacked by them for the second time. They did the same thing to us in 1978, took the lead and let it get away, and Danny White came in and, you know, through a sort of a Hail Mary pass, you know, at the end of the game, turned our DB around and it was a touchdown for them. And, you know, we blew a, I think it was a 17-point lead. Really had them beat in every way. And we were the only team that could really match up against Oakland. Of course, we played the Eagles the next week, and we'd already beaten them earlier in the year. So, yeah, that was our chance, you know. And you just can't let those chances, Dan Marino. Danny went to the Super Bowl his rookie year, and I'm sure there was a lot of talk in the locker room after that game that, hey, no worries, you know, we'll get back next year or the next year, you know. You just never know when those chances, unless you play for the Patriots, that is. Then you know about, you know, one, two out of every 3 years you're going to have a chance to play in the Super Bowl, which I still can't figure that out.
And Steve, talking about guys who should be in the Hall of Fame, let our listeners know how good Tommy Novus was.
Wow. He was by far the best football player I've ever been on the field with. He did what Lawrence Taylor did from the outside on the inside. Tommy made tackles from sideline to sideline. He had all the praise and accolades from the guys like Dick Butkus and the guys that played that position. They know how great Tommy was, and it's just an unbelievable slight for the Hall of Fame not to have come calling during Tommy's lifetime. It makes me sick to my stomach to see a guy who, I mean, I caught Tommy at the end of his career when he was playing on two knees that didn't work and still making tackles from sideline to sideline. Just played with the kind of heart that you just, you know, you read about, you know, in magazines, that, you know, about this guy that just, there's nothing more important to Tommy Novus than playing and leaving everything that he had from an ability standpoint on the field every game. I just wish that the Veterans Committee there at the Hall of Fame would wake up and realize, you know, spend some time looking at some of the film of number 60, and if that doesn't light you up, I don't know what will. Because Tommy did a lot of that on the field. He lit a lot of people up.
Bob, One more for Steve before we let him go?
Sure, Steve. I mean, you get to play in two Pro Bowls back-to-back, 80 and 81. Just tell us what it's like to be honored among your peers in that respect. And how about the Pro Bowl today, Steve? It's like a flag football game. I think it was taken a little bit more serious back then.
It really was, Bob, because, you know, the money we were getting salary-wise, I mean, it was like another game check for us. I can remember, you know, guys, really, you know, playing their tail off because, you know, the winners got, I forget what it was, 25,000, and the losers got, you know, 12,500, you know, and then now, I mean, I don't think there's any amount of money that would make those guys, you know, go out there and lay it on the line in an all-star game. Unfortunately, it's lost its luster. It's awesome to be, selected to the team. Don't get me wrong. And I think everybody counts it as an honor, but the game has lost what it was intended to display. And that is the football skills of the best in the league and under competitive circumstances. And it's just not that anymore. These guys are looking out for each other and I can't blame them. I mean, if, you know, they got millions of dollars on the line. So, you know, why get hurt in a real, you know, game that doesn't mean anything? You know, that's the bottom line. So, it'd be great if they could figure out a way to honor these guys without having the opportunity to get out there and sort of embarrass, you know, the league, you know, with the way they play that game. I don't know. I don't know what they can do to fix it, but it's sure an honor to be picked to the squad.
Steve, before we let you go, remind our listeners one more time about your lodge that you've got up there now in Montana and how they can get more information about it online and then on social media as well.
Yeah, the website, it's called Ruby Drake Lodge. If you go to www.rubydrakelodge.com, we have a pretty extensive website that'll fill in all the blanks. It'll show you all the pretty pictures, even though the pictures don't do it justice. It's an amazing place that we're we're thrilled to have guests and turn them on to the beauty and the splendor of Southwest Montana and these blue ribbon trout streams that, they are home to some of the most incredibly wonderful wild trout that you could ever put a fly in front of. So, you know, if people are interested, go on the website, www.rubydrakelodge.com, or give my son Pete a call at 406-925-9731. And thanks, guys, for having me on. Bob, Chris, it's always great to be with you guys, and I wish you the best.
Same to you.
Same to you, Steve. Thank you so much for your time tonight. We look forward to catching up with you again, hopefully real soon. In between now and then, all the best to you and your family, Steve.
You well, Steve.
Anytime, guys. Take care.
Good night.
That's the great Steve Barkowski. And Bob, like I say, one of the huge thrills was just getting to spend time talking to he and Lynn Cain and listen to them tell stories about time playing with the Falcons and just sort of just general football talk and the things that they got to be a part of. It's something I will definitely remember forever.
Yeah, my teen years were full of Steve Barkowski stories. My father loved them. You know, my father loved the California quarterbacks and would tell me about this guy and Joe Roth, the late Joe Roth, who played there. Those were just great times, Chris. And for a guy to play 12 years at the level that Steve did, was a tremendous football player. And obviously, you know him as a man, and he's a hell of a guy, too.
Yes, he is. All right, we've got our next guest, Tony Collins, hanging on the line. Going to get to Tony on the other side of this real quick station break.